session number 17436, reel 1.
Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Leighton, which at that time was in Essex, now part of London, East 10, on the 20th of May, 1924.
Did you have your schooling in Leighton?
I was educated locally up until I was 11, and then through my voice and singing, I went to Southwark Cathedral as a chorister and was thereby given a grant into Southwark into the school of St Olave's, which is just by the Belfast, used to be by the Belfast in Tooley Street, which meant that I travelled each day up from Leighton over Tower Bridge and home again of an evening after having gone to the cathedral for singing.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
Well, I was evacuated during the early part of the war and came home from Torquay when I was just turned 16.
You were evacuated to Torquay?
We were evacuated to Torquay and we shared with Torquay Grammar. They did mornings one term and we did afternoons in the school, and the next term we changed round. The rest of our time during the day was spent putting up air raid shelters and digging ditches and things like that.
Was your evacuation experience a happy one or an unhappy one?
I think it was reasonably happy. I was by myself with a greengrocer by trade, and I think he taught me how to skin rabbits, which were a rarity at that time. But I had to do my hands, do a bit of work at the greengrocer's.
How did the London boys get on with the Torquay boys?
Well, basically, because we were doing part and part around, there was very little actual mixing of the two schools. We were never in the school at the same time as Torquay Grammar, where, as I say, we did mornings and they did afternoons, and the next term it turned round, so there was very little mixing with the actual boys down there.
Which years do you think you were at Torquay?
Torquay, I went very early on. At the beginning of the war we were evacuated and they put us on a train in the initial sense. And we went to Uckfield in Sussex. Now, they were at Uckfield. There was 350 of us lads, and they were at Uckfield apparently expecting 120 mothers with babies, and we turned up. So we were living in barns and church halls and all sorts of peculiar places. And then so we were there for 6 weeks, and we went back onto the train again. They took us to Brighton in the train, where we sat in the sidings for a considerable period of time. Our girls' school was at Brighton at the time. Whether that was the reason for not wanting us there as well, I don't know, but from there we stayed on the train and went down to Torquay. So this would have been just before the declaration of war, because I was walking up Uxbridge High Street on the morning of declaration of war in September.
And when did you return to London?
I came home to London, I suppose, the latter end of beginning of 41. I came back, I think, to London, and having made a mess of an entrance examination that I was supposed to have taken, not made a mess of the exam, but having sent all the particulars to the wrong place, I hadn't got the employment that I had hoped for, and I joined the Prudential Assurance Company, knowing that I was only going to be with them for a period of time before I would be called up if the war continued. And I worked with those locally in their office until I volunteered for service in July, I think, 1942.
So at Torquay, or London for that matter, did you experience any air attacks by the Germans?
There were certain... There was aerial mines and things like that going on at the time, and bombing raids, ordinary bombing raids. There was one time there was quite a bit of air activity by the fighters' aircraft over the east side of London, which we used to stand and watch. But there was no serious damage in our particular area at that time. I did, even whilst in Torquay, was a member of the Scout movement before I went to Torquay. While I was down in Torquay, I got involved with the Scouts game with PAX Cubs down there. And when I came back to London, we of course had lost all our officers, had all been called up and were all in the services. So we were a unit, and I think that myself and one other lad, being what, 16, 17, were the oldest two there, and we decided that we would try and carry on. And we did, by means of joining up with another unit, we were active aboard the RRS Discovery on the Thames, where we did our training. We also used to, on a rotor system, we used to man a mine watch. Whenever there was a raid, during the daytime or night time, during the daytime there was a staff aboard the Discovery which manned it, but during the night time it was taken over by youngsters who would travel up and sleep the night aboard. But if there was an air raid, we manned a direction finder on the side of the vessel, the object being that if anything fell into the Thames in that reach, we took a bearing. The President, which is the other end of the reach, also took a bearing, and between us we would have a cross bearing of anything that landed. But that was manned night and day, only during air raid times. Now, whilst at Discovery, I got involved with the Y scheme, the Admiralty Y scheme. And this is where we did a fair amount of training on the water. I think possibly the only equivalent you could say was that the Y scheme was like a cadetship, as you have the cadets, the sea cadets and the army cadets working today, which meant that when I did go and volunteer for the Navy, I volunteered under the Y scheme. In other words, I had a certain element, not very much, but I had a certain element of pre-training. For argument's sake, at that time I had a watch certificate which permitted me in those days to take boats under oars on the Thames down as far as Tower Bridge. Well, now the Thames, of course, there's very little movement on the Thames now. In those days there were barges and tugs moored up all over the place, and of course moving up and down the river all the time, so it was quite a hectic place to be under oars. But this was my preparation, I suppose, in a way, under the Y scheme. So not that pulling boats would have helped much in the Navy, but at least you knew the terms and you were able to do knots and my new semaphore and things like that, which helped me and stood me in good stead later on.
When you were doing this work, plotting the position of bombs in the Thames, what status did you have? A Sea Scout?
We were Sea Scouts, yes.
How did you go about joining up?
Well, I've volunteered, I think, in July 42, and I went to Collingwood in September 42 for my ordinary seaman training.
What was that like?
Well, I started off there. I don't know whether I was the tallest person or what, but I started off, I was made a class leader at that time of, I think there must have been somewhere around about 28 to 30 of us in the hut. I quite enjoyed Conningwood training, as far as I was concerned, because I had a smattering of knowledge beforehand. It didn't really upset me. Also, I think that my previous experience with working with the scouting didn't worry. I wasn't worried about the communal life, living in one hut all of a sudden with a group of other people all bedding down openly and showering and things like that. So it stood me good stead there. At the initial training at Collingwood, I didn't have a great deal of problem with. There was only one thing that worried me at Collingwood. I was never a very good rope climber. So I think that I and another chap used to spend evenings trying to climb up and down the ropes of a night time or an evening to get a bit of practice in, because I felt that was one thing I lacked. But it was, there was no real major problems there, I don't think.
And after that?
Well, from there, from Collingwood, I went short leave home and then straight up to Loch Islet, the officers' training establishment in Loch Islet. Now, that was a different kettle of fish altogether, because that was very Spartan. Winter months, the cabins had a big stove in the middle of the room, and you were given a very, very small bucket of coal. But you were given an axe, and you were given a saw, and you were told if you wanted to keep warm, you had to go and collect your own fuel. It had other aspects there. If you wanted breakfast there, then we were right underneath a nice big hill. And if you wanted breakfast, you had to give your name in at the top to the PI, the instructor at the top of the climb, to get in for breakfast in the morning. So you've got a little bit of activity going on all the time. But there I had... I enjoyed myself there, but it was tough there. They used to put us out in the wilds at sentry boxes, miles from the camp. There was nobody else around, so you never saw anybody, but you'd stand your sentry duty in this isolated place in the wilds of Scotland. All sorts of noises, and you could imagine all sorts of things happening. They never did, but it was quite a spooky place to be standing sentry all by yourself about a couple of miles from the camp. And I'm afraid that we had a petty officer there who delighted in the situation, because he would come originally when you were on guard duty. He would turn up with a lantern, so you could see this lantern coming for a long way off. And then, of course, when you'd been on duty a couple of times, he'd come, but he wouldn't have his lantern. And he'd try and see how far he could get to you before you realised he was there. Did cause quite some funny episodes, his activities, but I can see his point. But it was a tough existence. Classes all the time, quite a bit of work. Well, there was a lot of work to be done, notebooks to be kept up and written and all the rest of it. The exam papers, which you did a mock exam before the finals of the exam. I received my pilotage paper back with just one word written across the front page in red, and that was all. It just had "dedigitate" written across the front page. No markings inside whatsoever. Everybody else had got their papers marked. I just turned up with this one word written across the front page.
What was that supposed to mean?
Well, tell me to get on with it. I thought I'd done quite well, but obviously I hadn't done as well as I should have done. Anyway, when the finals came, I had no problems with the papers or with the exams. And at Loch Islet, of course, you leave your after the exams, and on the morning of passing out, you leave your cabins, and if you get to the hallway, you've passed, because anybody that has failed their exams, you never see again, because they are taken aside and packed and off the premises before the parade is over. But that was quite satisfactory. Of course, I was, due to my age, I was made a midshipman at that time. And the first wardroom after being made a midshipman, all the new officers went to the wardroom for tea and biscuits. And I'm sure that the Wrens loved this, because the first thing they did was to give you a cup and a saucer in one hand, and then a plate with the other hand. Nowhere to sit down. So you standing there juggling a cup and a saucer and a plate, not being able to do anything with it at all. I think they thoroughly enjoyed that day. But we had, a little group of us, had sorted ourselves out. We were right at the far corner of the hall. And I saw our training officer, responsible for our section, and he was a 2.5 R&R. And he came in and made a beeline straight the way across the hall, stood in front of me, looked at me and said, "Draper, I believe you know my wife." My immediate reaction was saying, "No, sir, not me, sir." Well, in actual fact, it did transpire that I knew his wife, that I'd never met him before in his life. I did know his wife because she worked for the local post office where I was born, and I'd been to see her before I'd left for Loch Islet on holiday and told her where I was going. Well, she must have known this, because she must have told him. Hence the reason why I got digitate written across my pilotage paper. So it worked. But there was one other instant with this 2.5 RN, RNR, if you want, because a group of six of us stayed behind at Loch Islet as officers for an additional astro-navigational course. And we were, there was no means of us, we were still in our ordinary seaman's uniform, because there was no means of them doing anything about that, except in that, as opposed to the cadets were wearing white bands, we had dark blue bands, and we had cuffs with our ranks on them. But it did mean, while we were there for the month, we had to take our part in the duties there. And my first day as duty officer on the parade ground, I've never forgotten, because I'd received the reports of the cadets with their squads coming to me and reporting to me, telling me the state of their squads. This is the morning parade. I turned round, and there, a few paces away from me, was my 2.5 ringer RNR. So I proceeded to him and saluted. He duly accepted my salute, and he said to me, "Dismount, fight on foot." Turned round and walked off the parade ground, and left me standing there with all these hundreds of cadets behind me. And I know he went just offside that line and turned round to see what I would do. But fortunately, I was rehearsing. I knew what I'd got to do. But that was my first order, I think, I ever received as a naval officer. Dismount, fight on foot. But from Loch Islet, leave, and from there I went to HMS Armadillo, which is Ardentini, which was the Royal Naval Commando training base. And I was put into G1 Commando. This was a replacement commando because G Commando had already been in the North African landings. The remains of G1 had been incorporated into G2 and G3 units, and they were still in North Africa. G1 was a completely new unit being trained and would ultimately go to join them. Our training at Armadillo was quite a tough regime. You had two suits of khaki denims. No day went past, excepting for Saturday, no day went past that you didn't finish up soaking wet. We had an obstacle course, which took part or crossed a river, but you didn't use the bridge. You used to have to jump off the bridge into the river and go under the bridge. Also, being beach commandos, we had landing craft there.
And this is in the Scottish Highlands.
This is in the Scottish Highlands in Gare Loch, or Loch Long, rather. And they would delight that if the squad, or your unit, as I'm talking here of G1, were still dry, they would put you into a landing craft, take you out, bring you in, touch down the ramp, and start you going out. And the moment the ramp went down, the vessel would go astern. So in other words, the longer you took to get off the landing craft, the wetter you got, because the further you had to go through the water. But there wasn't a day went past. I say the only day that was left there was Saturday, and that was our day of rest, which meant that if you were quick, a Saturday morning there were lorries that went into Dunoon, and you could get across the ferry into Gourock, and you could just get into Glasgow, which meant that first thing you did in Glasgow was lay on a bed at the YMCA for Saturday night. You could have the day or the rest of the day in Glasgow. Sunday morning, first train back to Gourock, lorry the other side at Dunoon, back into camp, straight on to parade for a church service, and then Sunday became a normal working day. And here it was not only, it was as far as I was concerned, you were knowing the men, you had a bodyguard, and you had 10 men and an NCO, which was your section, and those people you had to get to learn, and everything you did with that group of men. There was one episode that we didn't do with them. There were some exercises away over the hills, and it was decided that the officers that were under training there would go as a unit, and instead of taking us by lorry, they decided that it would be a good idea if we marched. So a group of about 20 naval officers, mind you, all dressed in khaki, excepting for their naval caps, were marched this 20-odd miles across to the lake. Now, halfway along this route, on the top of one of the hills, there was a naval radio station. And there was a poor sentry, Matlow, at his sentry box at the front gate of this establishment. And he must have had the shock of his life, because all of a sudden this party of naval officers marched past him. He just stood there with his mouth wide open and let us get past him without any saluting or anything like that. Now, our officer in charge of us stopped the party went back and had a few polite words with the sentry, and I would sincerely hope that that sentry was relieved rather suddenly, because I think he might have had good cause to, having let a party of officers march past him. Anyway, we continued. We got to the exercise, and it was agreed, because I was going with G1, which was a reform unit and was expected to leave fairly shortly, I took part in the exercise that night, got soaking wet, did all my jobs as I should have done, finished the exercise early morning, joined up with the other party, and promptly got marched back to Armadillo. So I had a good exercise that day. But Armadillo was intentionally a tough regime. It had to be toughening up of everybody. And of course from here we embarked onto the Langkawi Castle in the Clyde, and which had at that time two flights of LCAs on either side, and the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry were aboard. And after a couple of days in the Clyde, we duly sailed from the Clyde, and there were, six or seven ships there with landing craft on them, all with troops and all loaded. We sailed out of the Clyde, every ship's horns were going, people were standing along the quayside, and everybody waved and all the rest of it, and we went out into the Atlantic. After about 5 days we returned to the Clyde. This went on about two or three times. I think on the third time we were back, the Langkawi fridges had broken down, so they fetched a barge alongside and threw all the food off that had gone rotten, and were starting to reload into the fridges again, and it was time to sail. So I think the captain or person in authority sort of said, okay, we'll cast off, we'll pick up the rest of the food when we come back. And I think this time we sailed, we didn't come back. We finished up going through to the Mediterranean for the landings at Sicily.
Anything special happened to you on the voyage?
It was a fascinating voyage, because when we got into the Med and you would get up in the morning and look, and everywhere you looked there were ships, and all round you there were ships. I don't know how anybody could miss seeing us, because there was, and this was constant during those last 3 to 4 days in the Med. It was a great surprise that we had no aerial activity, no other shipping activity, or nobody came against us at all. And yet there were big ships, small ships, little ones tossing all over the place, but no activity. And then the morning of the landing came, and the weather started to blow up a bit, and there was quite a heavy swell. I must say here that, of course, before our journey was over,